It's my pleasure to have been roped into chairing this. And the first speaker is Professor Valerie Hansen from, she's a historian from Yale University. She works on pre-modern China, particularly medieval period, and particularly relations between different ethnic, political, national groupings of the time. And she has just published a marvelous new book called The Silk Road, A New History, I believe.
Without documents is already old, and with documents is newer.
With documents is newer. So welcome, Valerie.
And my talk has disappeared.
Okay, I begin, sorry. Hello, everyone. You will have noticed that I have changed the date on my title. That was my mistake. That was not the mistake of the Collège de France. Collège de France never makes any mistakes. So let us begin. I'm talking today about a meeting that occurred in 1027, and I entitled my talk "The Group of Three." Basically, the group of three in terms of Central Asia, not the entire world. And we know that there was a meeting in 1027 at the court of the ruler of Afghanistan, Mahmud of Ghazni, and that two envoys walked from they walked from what's now Xinjiang in modern China, and they arrived at Mahmud's court. And they presented some gifts, which I'll be talking about later, and some diplomatic letters. And we know about this because of the writings of the historian Al-Marwazi, who wrote in Arabic about it. I was going to say, in terms of where they traveled, maybe easier here. Good. So they're starting. We're not actually sure where they started, probably somewhere around here, and they cross over. So this is the Buddhist world of North Asia, and they cross into, the world's regions in the year 1000, and the only region that is not round, right? This is the Islamic world, and they cross into Afghanistan. And this is map is very hard to see. It just gives you the outline of the Islamic world, so we'll skip that and go here. And we don't actually know where they went, where this meeting took place. It might have taken place in Mahmud of Ghazni's capital, which was in the modern city of Ghazni. We heard a little bit about it this morning. Or it might have taken place in Lashkari Bazaar, which was the Mahmud's winter palace. Al-Marwazi tells us who was at the meeting, or he identifies some of the people at the meeting. So we have the Ghaznavid ruler, Mahmud of Ghazni, who's been in power, this is for almost 30 years, that we have the an envoy, and then we have two envoys who walked. One of them came probably from Turfan. There were two Uyghur kingdoms at the time, and there's a possibility that it was not Turfan but Ganzhou, but I think it's more likely he came from Turfan. And then a representative of the Khitan peoples of who were governing much of that stretch of grasslands I showed you in North Asia, and who were the rulers of the Liao dynasty. The Karakhanids, I'll be talking about a little bit, because they were the allies of both the Ghaznavids and the Khitans, and they certainly must have been involved in the idea for this meeting. Also present at the meeting was the great, whenever people talk about him in English, they always call him a polymath, Al-Biruni. It's likely he learned about Chinese tea from talking to the Khitan envoy in Ghazni. And then we also know that there were women from North India who had moved up to the court Mahmud's court. There were also soldiers from North India. So this is the rare moment where we actually have some sense of who was in the room when this happened. This is a later picture of Mahmud of Ghazni. He received, at the point of his rule, the Abbasid Caliphate has already broken apart, and as a sign of his ascendancy as a regional ruler, he received a robe. This is a later painting from, a later book illustration from, you can see the early 1300s. And one of the things that when and the caliph sent him a robe and also bestowed two titles on him as basically protector of under the caliph. And one of the robe was a gift showing when you wore a robe that was given to you by another ruler, it was a way of showing submission, right? It was the robe perhaps had been worn by the ruler himself. So here is Mahmud. Oh, and the later picture we have, you can see that there's a variety of people in the picture, or the people have different coloring and different kinds of headgear, indicating that when people looked back on Mahmud's court, they thought of him as ruling over a cosmopolitan court. And the right before the summit, there were two marriages that took place among allies. So the leader of the Karakhanids had married his son to Mahmud's daughter, and then the following year, the leader of the Karakhanids had asked the Khitans to send a princess to marry his son. So the what happened at this meeting was that the Khitans, instead of going through the Karakhanids as their middle man, are going directly to Mahmud's court. The Karakhanids, many of you will know, had converted, the leader of the Karakhanids had converted to Islam in 955, and they conquered Khotan in 1006, and Rongxin Jiang has suggested that this may be why the cave at Dunhuang was closed. That basically the news of the Karakhanid conquest of Khotan caused people in Dunhuang to close the cave. And we have accounts in both Chinese and Arabic about the exchanges of envoys between the Khitans, the Liao dynasty, and other regional powers, including the Song and Goryeo Korea and Japan, and then these different powers in Central Asia. Oh, I'm sorry. The key thing here that was not on the previous slide is that we know that the Liao sent this envoy, Kali Tunka, in 1024, and he arrived in Ghazni in 1026, and the meeting took place in 1027. So he walked a long way. If there had been no impediments, it might have taken him, walked around 6,500 kilometers. It might have taken him, I would say, if he had smooth sailing, it could have taken 6 months or a year, but it seems to have taken him 3 years. And we don't know why. Now, the Liao, I think, are probably less familiar to everyone here. And this is an archaeologically informed map from Francois Louis about the Liao territory. And the purple outline shows all of the places within this large region. These are all the places that are mentioned in the Chinese record as having something to do with the Liao. But this purple core here is the archaeological core of the Liao. It's where some of the Liao capitals were, and many of the archaeological finds from there are similar, displays signs of shared archaeological culture. The Liao, this is an unusual painting. Most of the paintings we have of the Liao show, of the Khitan, show them from a Chinese point of view and tend to make them look more like barbarians. This is a more sympathetic painting. It's credited to, there was a Liao prince who was also a painter. And everything in this painting, this is a fairly, it's a copy, a later copy of an earlier painting. The things in this painting are of Liao manufacture. So we can see that they prize their animals. These are nomadic peoples. They're the ancestors of the Mongols. And I shouldn't say the physical ancestors. They're forerunners of the Mongols. And they're also prize hunting. The main source of what we know about Liao court culture, the material aspects of Liao court culture, is this one tomb that has not been disturbed. There's lots and lots of Liao tombs, but the one tomb that hasn't been disturbed is the Princess of Chun tomb. And I just will show you some slides of different things that show that, and this is before the meeting, this is 9 years before the meeting, the time of burial. There's some evidence in the written sources that when a member of the royal family died, they were buried with gifts from envoys that had been presented by diplomats from neighboring rulers. So we have this brass plate, and so I'm showing you the picture from the Princess of Chun tomb, but telling you on the basis of comparisons with other archaeological material where things probably came from. So this is a brass plate from Nishapur, and this is the a glass bottle, as you can see, probably from Syria or Egypt. A rock crystal bowl. Rock crystal was particularly cherished because it's translucent, so it looks like glass, but it shatters very easily. So to make something so small and beautiful was very difficult. Amber was the favorite object of the Khitan. We know from chemical testing that it was shipped from the Baltic. We also have know that because of textual descriptions of it. And I was going to say, we have so we know from Marwazi, again, the historian who tells us about these letters, that the goods that the Chinese and presumably the Khitan imported from the Islamic world were, so ivory, but the ivory was not elephant ivory, it's walrus ivory. And frankincense, an aromatic, and this is a period when aromatics are deeply prized. People are always trying to change the way that rooms smell or their robes smell or the way they smell. And then the amber, Al-Marwazi tells us about the amber, and he tells us it's Slavonic. So it's from the land of the Slavs. It's from the Baltic, which chemical testing has confirmed. And then there's this word hutu, which is a loan word from Khitan that Laufer first identified as meaning walrus tusk. And we have descriptions in Chinese that show that the Chinese believed that if you put a piece of walrus tusk in your hand and next to poison, the tusk would start to sweat. The tusk would give off a liquid. And then we know from Al-Marwazi what the Khitan envoy brought. So I was going to say, that's the trade, the archaeological evidence we have of trade between the Khitan and the Middle East, the Islamic world. In this particular case, what I want to talk about today is that we know what this envoy brought from, sent by the Liao emperor to Mahmud of Ghazni, because we have the content, we have the description. And so he brought, the first two items are suits. The word in Arabic is just taub. It just means like a robe or a tunic. We don't know exactly what it was like. And the reason that he could bring so many things, or he brought things in silk, was that the Liao had bested the Chinese in, the Liao had invaded China, and the Chinese had decided that they would, rather than continue to fight, they would just pay an annual indemnity to the Liao, and they paid part of that in 100,000 bolts of silk. The Liao, so he also brought animal skins. These were the product of the Liao emperor that their subject people presented to the Khitan rulers. The musk is from Tibet. And then the one bow with 10 arrows was a symbolic gift indicating the desire to become allies. And then, maybe most interesting, because we don't usually learn about why people give each other gifts or what they hoped to achieve, is we've got this is the English translation, this is Minorsky's translation, with a few slight modifications, of the letter that the Liao emperor sent to Mahmud of Ghazni. And we don't know what language the original letter was in, but it seems likely it was in some Turkic language. So here, the Liao emperor is explaining why he's sending this envoy. And basically, he wants to establish diplomatic relations because he wants letters and presents. All right, so if you imagine yourself as a ruler at this time, a source of pleasure is exotic gifts from other places. And then Shenzong continues in his letter saying that, and this is interesting about what he's heard about Mahmud from across all of Asia. He knows that how powerful Mahmud is, and that he has conquered a large territory. And then he says, but you haven't written to me, right? You are so important, and you are so high, but you haven't been in touch with me, and we need to fix this. We need to establish diplomatic relations. And then he says he wants to establish these diplomatic relations. He would like the Mahmud to send him an envoy. And then the purpose of the exchanges will be an exchange of opinions, right? How we the Khitan, see things in the world. And we will also establish mutual gift giving. Okay, so this gives us a specific example of someone moving across a large expanse of territory to establish this relationship. And then the surprise in the correspondence is what Mahmud says in reply, because he says the purpose of having allies is to prevent fighting. There's two things that he's talking about. One is why you have allies, and he says that Liao are so far away, he doesn't really need to be allied with them, because there's such a great distance that there's security, right? You're so far from us, you can't attack. But he also points out that the Liao are not Muslims, all right? There's no faith uniting us. And there's no ambiguity here, because he says, if you were to convert to Islam, get back in touch, right? Then I'll be interested in being allied with you. But so in terms of evidence from the ground that people at the time were thinking in terms of religious blocks, this is very clear evidence. Except we do have the issue of where I'm working with one source. And is there any reason that we would doubt al-Marwazi's account? My short answer would be no. I think he's a fairly careful reporter. Some of the information is high quality. He knows that China is divided between the Liao and the Sung, and the Uyghurs who were then in Xinjiang, and there's a lot of stereotyping of the Chinese as being extremely skillful in making crafts. And he tells a story, which presumably something he did not witness himself, that he heard from someone about courtiers coming into the court, to the Liao emperor's, the Chinese emperor's court, the Sung court. And each courtier takes a piece of wood off of a block. And so the first courtier takes off the first chip of wood, and the second one takes the second chip. And then magically, a beautiful statue is made, because the Chinese are so gifted at making crafts. Okay, so there's some stereotyping. He gives some information where he also indicates that his information may not be correct, so that he's not simply reporting everything that he hears. He makes some mistakes. He thinks the Chinese are Manichaean. And the Uyghurs had been Manichaean until around 1000. So we can understand how he would have made that mistake. Something he doesn't tell us about is where the meeting occurred. And I was just in Copenhagen at the David Collection, where they had a conference. Each of us was supposed to pick something in the collection of the David Collection and talk about it. And this was my item because it's one of the things that may have, it may have existed at the time of this meeting, or it may have been made a little bit after. It's not, and here's the caption from the museum. The workmanship is not perfect. Especially of the animals on the top band, as you can see that the figure on the right may be a bear, but it also kind of looks like a tapir. And the figure on the left is even more problematic, that it has an elephant's trunk, and it might have an elephant's tusk right there, but it doesn't have an elephant's body. It looks like kind of a greyhound body. It does have elephant feet. So it's not clear that the person making this had seen an elephant. I was gonna say, so we don't know if the meeting occurred there or at Lashkari Bazaar, which is Mahmud's winter capital. And at Lashkari Bazaar, there was no marble there. So that stone I just showed you has to have come from Ghazni, or at least it cannot have come from Lashkari Bazaar. Another thing that Al-Marwazi doesn't tell us about, that we know about from a different historian writing in Persian, is the lavish court ceremony that was characteristic of the Ghaznavids. We know that Mahmud's son, Masud, had a ceremony in 1038, and you can read about this, but basically he had a crown in the center of the room. The crown was suspended from chains above his head. There were the four human figures are statues. I should have said that. Statues holding up the crown. Everything was covered with carpets and brocades. There were lavish gifts, 380 golden dishes, all holding more aromatics, camphor and musk, sandalwood. You would think that when the Liao envoy arrived, if he saw anything like this, I mean, it's likely he saw something like this, but that Marwazi has not included it in his account. So I come back to these world regions around the year 1000, because I've been writing a book about them, and each section of the book talks about these different regions. I was going to say, one of my conclusions is that, I'm sure you all know this book, The Finbar Floods, Objects of Translation, but it's a very careful study arguing that when we look back on the past, we use these categories of Hindu and Muslim more than people at the time did. And that they tended to use ethnic categories like Arab or Persian or Turk, and sometimes these were determined on the basis of language, and sometimes they were determined on the basis of what people wore. But Mahmud of Ghazni, when he turns the Liao emperor down, he turns him down because he is not a Muslim. And he sees a line between the Islamic region of Central Asia and the Buddhist region of East Asia. And he doesn't know this, but that line is going to move eastward in the next couple of centuries as Xinjiang gradually converts to Islam. And something that we can see all over the world, well, I should say all over Afro-Eurasia, not necessarily all over the world, in the year 1000, is that people define world regions in terms of religion. And rulers, when they become the head of a large group of people, often choose to follow one religion and not to follow another. And many of those decisions are motivated by finding powerful allies. So just a couple of examples. We've got Harald Bluetooth, who converts to Christianity. This is in Scandinavia. We've got Vladimir of Rus, who adopts Christianity. He adopts the Christianity of Byzantium. Vladimir of Rus is interesting because we have an account that tells us about the options, and he makes a decision not to convert to Islam and to convert to Eastern Orthodoxy, and not to convert to Judaism, and not to convert to the Christianity of Rome. And we have also the Seljuks converting to Islam. There's many more examples. But this is the product of these larger regional groupings that are forming around the year 1000 when people are coming into contact with each other for the first time. And so here is my book cover. I'm so excited. Let me finish with some thank yous. Thank you very much.